The Wake Up Call with Richard Martin, Mondays and Fridays at 9 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to the Wake Up Call, coming to you from Singapore through PRN in New York City. And it is Friday, March the 2nd. Now, on Monday, I talked to you about the retailing aspects of commercial real estate. Let me share with you today some of the more general outrages connected with real estate in the last few years. A systematic plan to create the illusion of stability and provide no-risk profits to the mega Wall Street banks was implemented in early 2009 and continues today. The plan was developed by Ben Bernanke, Hank Paulson, Tim Geithner, and the CEOs of the Criminal Wall Street Banking Syndicate. The plan has been enabled by the FASB, the SEC, IRS, the FDIC, and a number of corrupt politicians in Washington, D.C. This master plan has funneled hundreds of billions from taxpayers to the banks that created the greatest financial collapse in world history. Part two of the master cover-up plan has been the extending of commercial real estate loans and pretending that they will eventually be repaid. In late 2009, it was clear to the Federal Reserve and the Treasury that the $1.2 trillion in commercial loans maturing between 2010 and 2013 would cause thousands of bank failures if the existing regulations were enforced. The Treasury stepped up to the plate first. New rules at the IRS weren't directly related to banking, but allowed commercial loans that were part of investment pools known as real estate mortgage investment conduits, or REMICs, to be financed without triggering tax penalties for investors. The Federal Reserve, which, remember, is tasked with making sure bank loans are properly valued, instructed banks throughout the country to extend and pretend, or amend and pretend, in which the bank gives a borrower more time to repay a loan. Banks were encouraged to modify loans to help cash-strapped borrowers. The hope was that by amending the terms to enable the borrower to avoid a refinancing that would have been impossible, the lender would ultimately be able to collect the balance due on the loan. Bernanke and his henchmen also pushed banks to do troubled debt restructurings. Such restructurings involved modifying an existing loan by changing the terms or breaking the loan into pieces. Banks, thrift, and credit union regulators very quietly gave lenders flexibility in how they classified distressed commercial mortgages. Banks were able to slice distressed loans into performing and non-performing loans, and institutions were able to magically reduce the total reserves set aside for non-performing loans. If a mall developer has 40% of their mall vacant and the cash flow from the mall is insufficient to service the loan, the bank would normally need to set aside reserves for the entire loan. Under the new guidelines, they could carve the loan into two pieces, with 60% that is covered by cash flow as a good loan and the 40% without sufficient cash flow, which would be classified as non-performing. The truth is that billions in commercial loans are in distress right now because tenants are dropping like flies. Rather than write down the loans, banks are extending the terms of the debt with more interest reserves included so they can continue to classify the loans as performing. The reality is that the values of the property behind these loans have fallen 43%. Banks are extending loans that they would never make now because borrowers are already grossly upside down. You have to admire the resourcefulness of the vested interests in disguising disaster and pretending that time will alleviate the consequences of their insatiable greed, blatant criminality, and foolish risk-taking. Extending bad loans and pretending that they will be repaid does not create the cash flow necessary to actually pay the interest and principal on the debt. You can see what happened between 2005 and 2008 in the commercial real estate market. There was an epic feeding frenzy of overbuilding shopping centers, malls, office space, industrial space, and apartments. During the sane 1980s and 1990s, commercial real estate loan issuance stayed consistently in the 500 to 700 billion range. The internet boom led to a surge to 1.1 trillion in 2000, with the resultant pullback to 900 billion by 2004. But thanks to Easy Al and Helicopter Ben, the bubble was reinflated with easy money and zero regulatory oversight. Commercial real estate loan issuance skyrocketed to 1.6 trillion per year by 2008. Bankers sure have a knack for doing the exact opposite of what they should be doing at exactly the wrong time. They doled out a couple of trillion dollars of loans to delusional developers at peak prices just prior to a historic financial cataclysm. The difference between bad retail mortgage loans and bad commercial loans is about 25 years. Commercial real estate loans usually have 5 to 7 year maturities. This meant that an avalanche of loans began maturing in 2010 and will not peak until 2013. With $1.2 trillion of loans coming due between 2010 and 2013, disaster for the Wall Street too-big-to-fail banks awaited if the properties were valued honestly. A perfect storm of declining property values and plunging cash flows for developers should have resulted in enormous losses for Wall Street banks and their shareholders, resulting in executives losing not only their obscene bonuses, but even their jobs. Imagine the horror for the 0.01%. The fact is that commercial property prices are currently 42% below the 2007-2008 peak. The slight increase in the national index is solely due to strong demand for apartments, as millions of Americans have been kicked out of their homes by Wall Street bankers using fraudulent loan documentation to foreclose on them. The national index has recently assumed its fall. Industrial and retail properties are leading the descent in prices, according to Moody's. The master plan of extend and pretend was implemented in 2009, and 3 years later, commercial real estate prices are 10% lower after the official end of the recession. Part one of the extend and pretend plan has failed. Part two anticipated escalating developer cash flows as the economy recuperated. Americans resumed spending like drunken sailors retailers began to rake in profits at record levels again. Reality has interfered with their last-ditch gamble. Office vacancies remain at 17.3%, close to 20-year highs, as 12.3 million square feet of new space came to market in 2011. Vacancies are higher today than they were at the end of the recession in December 2009. The recovery in cash flow has failed to materialize for commercial developers. Strip mall vacancies are at 11%, remain stuck at 20-year highs. Regional mall vacancies at 9.2% linger near all-time highs. Vacancies remain elevated with no sign of decreasing. Despite these figures, an additional 4.9 million square feet of new retail space was opened in 2011. The folly, the absurdity of this continued expansion will be revealed as bricks and mortar retailers are forced to close thousands of stores in the next 5 years. It is absolutely clear that the plan put into place 3 years ago has failed. Extending and pretending doesn't service debt. Only cash flow can service debt. Analysts expect 2012 to be a record-setting year for commercial real estate defaults. Last week, delinquencies for loans hit their highest level ever, according to Fitch Ratings. The value of all delinquent commercial loans is now $57.7 billion, according to TREP LLC. If you think the criminal Wall Street banks limited their robo-signing fraud to just poor homeowners, you would be mistaken. The fraud uncovered in the commercial lending orbit will dwarf the residential swindle. Research by Harbinger Analytics Group shows the widespread use of inaccurate, fraudulent documents for land title underwriting of commercial real estate financing. According to the report, this fraud is accomplished through inaccurate and incomplete filings of statutory records required, that's commercial land surveys, detailed physical boundaries, encumbrances, encroachments, etc., on commercial properties in California, many other Western states, and possibly throughout most of the United States. In the cases studied by Harbinger, the problems are because banks accepted the work of land surveyors who, quote, have committed actual and or constructive fraud by knowingly failing to conduct accurate boundary surveys and or failing to file the statutorily required documentation in public records, end of quote. So you see, the Wall Street geniuses bundled commercial real estate mortgages and resold them as securities around the world, and the suckers holding those securities, already staggering from the overabundant empty office space, will be devastated if it turns out they have no claim to the properties. They will rightly sue the lenders for falsely representing the properties, and the mortgage holders in these cases may also turn to their title insurance to cover any losses. It's unknown if the title insurance companies have the wherewithal to withstand enormous claims on costly commercial properties. It looks like that proverbial light at the end of the tunnel is a bullet train headed our way. All right, ladies and gentlemen, let me give you my information. It's Richard Martin talking to you from Singapore, and the show is Wake Up Call, and the toll-free number to talk to me and to your brethren in kind on the show listening is 888-874-4888. That is a toll-free number. Again, 888-874-4888. And we are standing by to receive your calls, so please let them flow fast and furious. And if you'd rather send in an email with your questions and whatever it is on your mind, you are very welcome to do that too. The email system is alive and well, and you should write to rm@gfawd.com. That's again, RM Richard Martin at gfawd.com. And GFAWD stands for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design. And if you'd like to talk to me in private and get my take on your personal financial situation, please feel free to call me anytime. If I'm not here, please leave your name and a message. And you may call a number in Sarasota, Florida at area code 941-441-1682. That's again, 941-441-1682. It's my direct line which connects up automatically with Singapore. So again, call me anytime and leave a message if I'm not here. And finally, the new time for the next meetup group, the Richard Martin meetup group in New Brunswick, New Jersey, will be Sunday, March the 25th at 2 p.m. And the same place, the George Street Ale House at 378 George Street. And Susan is the moderator. Please, the person to call to get further information and to register your intention to be present. And her number is 202-246-5131. Again, that's Susan at 202-246-5131. All right. Well, very quickly, let's have a look at just how grim the Greek solvency situation really is. Greece's national debt stands at 160% of GDP, compares with the United States at 100%, and that's already very critical. And in order to get relief from the rest of the Eurozone, which really means Germany, the Greek government had to agree to get that percentage ratio down to 120.5% by 2020. Now, in order to do that, Greece has introduced severe austerity measures that will slash 150,000 government jobs, cut private sector wages by 22%, reduce or eliminate pensions, sell off public enterprises, and raise taxes. All this in a country where employment among those under 25 is just under 50%. That's 50%. You see, here's the catch-22. If the government were even able to do all of this, and that, by the way, is a very big if, the immediate effects on the Greek economy would be crushing. The austerity measures are bound to shrink the economy, thus making the debt-to-GDP ratio even worse. Meanwhile, bondholders have agreed to a 50% cut in value, and the second round of bailouts just announced allows Greece temporarily to avoid a default. So, what happens now? Within Greece, the people have to agree with what their leaders have promised to its Eurozone benefactors. The question, really, is as to whether they will accept the extreme hardships that will be imposed on them. Greece is, after all, a democracy. Ultimately, the government will either respond to what the people want, or it will fail. The results, or rather the riots and the burning of buildings in Athens, are not hopeful signs for the current government. Germany, which essentially controls the Eurozone, is a democracy as well. You really have to wonder just how many billions of their money the German people will sacrifice to prop up a country they consider irresponsible. Contrary to many press reports, Germany has demonstrated more than most countries are willing to take on the burdens of others. West Germany shouldered a Herculean economic load when the wall came down and it merged with East Germany. but a strong majority of Germans don't believe they should finance a country like Greece, particularly when the social benefits offered there have been greater than their own. Put yourself in a German's place. You picked up your newspaper last October and read that Diomidis Spinellis, Secretary General of the Special Task Force to Stop Tax Evasion in the Greek Finance Ministry, had thrown up his hands in disgust and quit because of what he described as a deficit of management will to stop the corruption that permeates the tax system. Obviously, the systematic tax evasion that has long been part of Greek culture is proving difficult to change. Spinellis charged that tax collectors continue to skim off the top of taxes they do collect, and many publicly identified tax avoiders have still not paid their taxes. Are the Germans really going to support their government if it wants to send more of their money to this place? In addition, if you are a law-abiding Greek taxpayer, given what austerity is doing to your job or your business, paying greatly increased taxes may prove to be impossible. There are lots of catch-22s in this terrible crisis, and they should have been taken into account when the Eurozone was first established. The countries that joined gave up control of their individual monetary policies when they lost the ability to control their money supply. It was clear from the beginning that Germany would end up in effective control of Eurozone monetary policy because of its size, economic power, and culture. It should also have been clear that part of that culture was a deeply ingrained fear of inflation, a legacy of the collapse of the Weimar Republic. Ladies and gentlemen, we are watching a tragedy unfold, one that will ultimately have wide-ranging negative effects on the American economy. You know, America has become a crazy, controlled environment where almost everything seems to be illegal. One California town is actually considering making it illegal to smoke in your own backyard. In Louisiana, a church was recently ordered to stop giving out water because it didn't have a permit to do so. It is illegal to operate a train in the United States that doesn't have an F painted on the front. Apparently without that F, we all might not know where the front of the train is. In many states, it's now illegal to collect rain that falls from the sky onto your own property. In America today, it's illegal to milk your cow and sell the milk to your neighbor. If you do this, there's a good chance that federal agents will raid your home at the crack of dawn. In Washington, D.C., it's illegal not to recycle cat litter. It is illegal to give a tour of the monuments in Washington, D.C. without a license. It is illegal to sell natural cures for cancer, even if they work. In Massachusetts, it's illegal to deface a milk carton. In Alabama, bear wrestling is completely illegal. In Fairbanks, Alaska, it is illegal to give alcoholic beverages to a moose. In Lake Elmo, Minnesota, it's illegal to sell pumpkins or Christmas trees that are grown outside city limits. There is a federal law that makes it illegal to be annoying on the Internet. If you register with a false name on MySpace or Facebook, you could potentially, quote, spend 5 years in federal prison, unquote. In Hazelwood, Missouri, it's illegal for little girls to sell Girl Scout cookies in their front yards of their own homes. All over the United States, lemonade stands run by children are being shut down because they don't have the proper permits. In Florida, it's illegal to bring a plastic butter knife to school. In San Juan Capistrano, California, it's illegal to hold a home Bible study without a conditional use permit. In the city of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, it's illegal to make even a single dollar from a blog unless you buy a $300 business license. This list of crazy laws and ridiculous regulations could actually be thousands long. I've just plumbed the surface here. Well, people who have nothing to eat, no job, and are about to be tossed out of their homes in foreclosure really do not know what stress is. To appreciate stress fully, please consider the sorry plights of Andrew Schiff, marketing director for Euro-Pacific Capital and brother to his more famous CEO, Daniel Arbini, a Wall Street headhunter and hedge fund manager Richard Shiner. Bloomberg describes the out-and-out horror stories of all of these three in an article entitled "Wall Street Bonus Withdrawal Means Trading Aspet for Coupons," Andrew Schiff said. The $350,000 he earns, enough to put him in the country's top 1% by income, doesn't cover his family's private school tuition, a Kent, Connecticut summer rental, and the upgrade they would like from their 1,200-square-foot Brooklyn duplex, and I quote, "People who don't have money don't understand the stress," said Alan Dugash, a partner at accounting firm Marks, Paneth & Schron, LLP in New York, who specializes in financial planning for the wealthy. Quote again, "Could you imagine what it's like to say, I got three kids in private school, I have to think about pulling them out? How do you do that? Wall Street's cash bonus pool fell by 14% last year to $19.7 billion, the lowest since 2008, according to projections by New York State Comptroller Thomas DiNapoli. It's a disaster," said Ilana Weinstein, chief executive officer of New York-based search firm IDW Group, LLC. "The entire construct of compensation has changed." Wall Street headhunter Daniel Arbini said his income has gone down tremendously. On a recent Sunday, he drove to Fairway Market in the Red Hook section of Brooklyn to buy discounted salmon for $5.99 a pound. Richard Shiner, 58, a real estate investor and hedge fund manager, said most people on Wall Street don't save. Shiner said he spent about $500 a month to park one of his two Audis in a garage, and at least $7,500 a year each for memberships at the Trump National Golf Club in Westchester and a gun club in upstate New York. A labradoodle named Zelda and a rescued bison Frisk Duke cost $17,000 a year, including food, health care, boarding, and a daily dog walker who charges $17 each per outing, he said. He described a feeling of malaise and a paralysis that doesn't allow one to believe that generally things are going to get better. Listing geopolitical hotspots such as Iran and low interest rates that have been artificially manipulated by the Federal Reserve. The malaise is shared by Schiff, the New York-based marketing director for Euro-Pacific Capital. His family rents the lower duplex of a brownstone in Cobble Hill, where his two children share a room. His 10-year-old daughter is a student at $32,000 a year Poly Preps County Day School in Brooklyn. His son, 7, will apply in a few years. "I can't imagine what I'm going to do," Schiff said. "I'm crammed into 1,200 square feet. I don't have a dishwasher. We do all our dishes by hand." He wants a 1,800 square foot, a room for each kid, three bedrooms, maybe four, he said. "Imagine four bedrooms. You have the luxury of a guest room. How crazy is that?" The family rents a three-bedroom summer house in Connecticut and will go there again this year for 1 month instead of four. Schiff said he brings home less than $200,000 after taxes, health insurance, and 401k contributions. "I wouldn't want to whine," Schiff said. "All I want is the stuff that I always thought growing up that successful parents had." All right, ladies and gentlemen, while I take some time off to withdraw some Kleenex and deal with the current situation upon my weary brow, I will allow you to take a break, and I will be right back. Okay, remember this? Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. That is from the First Amendment of the Constitution of the United States of America, 17th of September, 1787. Well, it seems like every day brings us one step closer to a totalitarian police state, and today is no exception. There is now a little-known bill that was overwhelmingly approved by the House of Representatives, H.R. 347, vote tally 388-3, and the Senate, that's S-1794, passed with unanimous consent. No voting records were kept of which senators approved. Federal Restricted Buildings and Grounds Improvement Act of 2011 amends the Federal Criminal Code to revise the prohibition against entering restricted federal buildings or grounds to impose criminal penalties on anyone who knowingly enters any restricted building or grounds without lawful authority. As it turns out, the two-page bill deals not just with fence jumpers, but also lays the groundwork for all protests, gatherings, and political dissent in any facility or grounds in the United States of America that has been identified as a place of national significance or where the Secret Service is charged with the protection of an individual, any individual, whether it's the president, a congressional member, or anyone else of national interest. For those who will undoubtedly be charged under the new legislation, the penalties will be severe. If you are found to possess a weapon deemed as dangerous, not necessarily a gun, when you knowingly enter an event of national significance, you can be imprisoned for up to 10 years. If you are a peaceful, unarmed protester and you disrupt an event, you'll be treated with a bit more mercy by the benevolent leaders and be given up to 1 year in prison. With what we've seen over the last few years in Greece, Greater Europe, Syria, and even the United States, the legislation makes complete sense from a government standpoint. What better way to keep dissenters and protesters quiet than to imprison them for months or years? It will take only a few public examples the next time a Tea Party or Occupy-style protest takes place, and millions of Americans will understand that staying home and staying silent is their new patriotic duty. And if it so happens that protests turn to violent rioting and civil unrest, the government will have the pretext to arrest, detain, and imprison anyone and everyone in those restricted areas of national significance. As usual, my overriding question would be, how does anybody think they have any defense against this? What possible good does it do to get thrown in prison for 6 months to make a point? How do you win against stuff like this, ladies and gentlemen? And frankly, without answers to these questions, you don't have a future in the United States. I'm sorry, but nobody wins against totalitarianism. Stay and fight. You're very welcome. Be my guest. But I'm afraid brutal reality will catch up with you long before you exhaust the patience of your principles. All right, let's take a couple of emails here. One comes from Steve, who says, and that would be, of course, Steve Kruger. Dear Richard, I know you advise getting out of real estate debt ASAP, and I want to get your opinion. I have three scenarios regarding selling my small home. By the way, I think this is not Steve Kruger. I wrote down Steve, but I think it's another Steve. For now, I'm able to meet the monthly payment, but my interest rate is 8% and refinancing is not possible in my situation due to being self-employed. I'm currently well underway moving out of the US to the Czech Republic. 1. Selling. Realtor suggests repairs to get the best price. After repairs, best case sale would pay off the mortgage realtor commission and maybe the repair investment. I would need to invest $5,000 in repairs to get the house ready for sale. 2. As is sale and hope for the best. This way I would stay in a cash position instead of investing my small reserve into repairs with no guarantee of a sale. 3. Hang on to the house until the SHTF, which I will leave to your vivid imaginations to understand what that means, ladies and gentlemen, and keep my mental energy and dollars freed up. Thanks for all you do, Steve. Steve, quite clearly, to my way of thinking, you need to get out of that place as fast as possible. Put it on the market, get what you can, and skedaddle. That's my advice to you. The sooner you can act on your newfound plans to escape to the Czech Republic, the happier you will be, and basically at least some of your problems will be solved at a stroke. So that would be my advice. If you have to make any kind of changes, nothing stops you from negotiating with the buyers once you've seen that there is an interest. And your realtor can decide what kind of interest is involved with you having to make some small changes and upgrades. You can then negotiate that out as and when. But I think at this point, to make changes in the hopes of really getting a better price or even more chances of selling the home is a fruitless exercise. So I would tend to sell as quickly as possible. So that hopefully will give you some indication. I did get an email from Susan, that's our dearly beloved moderator of the Richard Martin Meetup group. A few days ago, she sent me an email with some things that she disagreed with. And she says, hi, Richard, here are more things that I disagree with. Well, I appreciate that, Susan. I ask for no more than that people who disagree with me should make their voices heard, and couldn't be less true this time round. So what I'll do, Susan, is I'll take each of your points one by one rather than reading them all out first, and we'll see where I go with it. Okay, number one, I think that we do need to learn how to do practical things like grow food, filter water, economize, make things from scratch, filter water, second time there, Susan, defend ourselves and the like, regardless of whether we choose to move abroad or stay in the U.S. Couldn't agree with you more, Susan. If the more skill that people can develop, whether or not they live in a big city where obviously it's going to be hard to grow food, the more you can develop skills of all sorts, the better off you will be, especially at a time when your own self-help will be of paramount importance in the years ahead. So I absolutely agree with you. I'm not sure if I've ever said that you shouldn't do these things, but clearly if I haven't emphasized the importance of doing them, Susan, you have definitely enlightened me and company present. So yes, please, ladies and gentlemen, go out there, buy those, do this and do that for dummies, and whatever it takes, get some skills together, some home skills. Not at all a bad idea. Number two, I think that there are legitimate reasons for FEMA having the authority to seize private automobiles and order people to move temporarily. A good example is in cases of natural disasters like Katrina or a nuclear plant meltdown. Again, I'm trying to think of things to disagree with on that score, Susan. I'm not sure that I've stated a disagreement with that in the past. Clearly, under legitimate circumstances, the authorities do have the right, and they do need to be able to exercise that right to move around freely and to direct the population accordingly. The trouble, Susan, is that so often this right is abused. You see it constantly in the Occupy groups by the police taking on powers that manifestly They don't really have, and they certainly don't have them morally. If they're found to have them in practice, a lot of those powers are misplaced. And that's the problem with the police these days. It's that they don't use their discretion with any degree of validity. And so I think that it's important to distinguish, and Susan, I'm sure you'd agree with me, between those powers that are genuine and those that are trumped up in order to make the police's work easier and to support the will of the wealthy and the privileged, which is really what it all amounts to. Number three, it seems to me that the Europeans are printing money and have been for some time in their own way. I'm no economist, thank God, but isn't that essentially what the following quote from Ambrose Evans-Pritchard is saying, and I quote, "Private credit spiraled out of control in part because the European Central Bank missed its inflation target every month for almost 9 years and gunned the Eurozone M3 money supply at double the bank's own target rate to help Germany, then in trouble," end of quote. Susan, there are various different ways to skin a cat here. It is true, and I actually sent an email to my designated email distribution group just today, explaining about the money printing in Europe and how they are printing money, but how the money is not getting through to the economy any more than it is in the United States. It's the same principle. The banks are printing desperately, but the commercial banks are simply not willing to lend it out. So it becomes like a pointless exercise. And this is a recent development, Susan. So whereas I may have said before that they were not printing money, clearly at this point they are, and this is in the last, you know, week, 10 days. So you are absolutely right to disagree with me here. It is a fact that the Europeans are printing. What we need to see happen now is where this money is going to go. Finally, number four, I suspect that maybe a lot of the increase in credit here in the U.S. is not just people using credit, but people who tightened their belts and now feel that the economy is getting better and so are spending again. Also, old spending habits are hard to change. We are used to changing what we want. We're used to charging what we want. People are spending again. We've seen this in some of the figures. I think I've mentioned that in the last couple of shows. People basically are being encouraged to spend, and unfortunately, the government is the malefactor here. The government is telling people to go out and spend money to try to prop up the prices and the economy and all these things. And unfortunately, people are beginning to do that. And we're seeing that, obviously, because the savings rate has declined quite spectacularly, actually, over the last few weeks. This can only happen if Americans are spending. The economy, I disagree with you. The one major disagreement that I have with you is that the economy is getting better. I don't know whether you believe that to be true, Susan, or whether that's just how, as you correctly put, the consumers feel that the economy is getting better. But my job on the wake-up call, and indeed everything that I do, is designed to help you understand, ladies and gentlemen, the economy is most definitely not getting better, despite what people may say, despite how people may be manipulating the statistics to make it look as though it is getting better. So this is very cruel, and those people who are out there spending money who shouldn't be spending are unfortunately going to put themselves right back into the pickle they were in before, when they were either close to bankruptcy or certainly finding it difficult to make ends meet. So do take it from me, ladies and gentlemen, there is no economic recovery. I've said this over and over again, and Susan, you've very kindly given me the opportunity to repeat that, that there is no sense. And in fact, last week I gave a whole shopping list of reasons and basic economic statistics to show that the economy was not getting better. So again, if anybody wants to call in and disagree with me, please feel free to do so. I would be very interested to know how people feel that the economy is getting better. I'm getting anecdotal information all the time. Somebody I know just lost his job just yesterday. Everywhere around you, people are struggling. Where this idea that the economy is improving comes from, I just have no idea. So thank you very much indeed for that. Five, Susan's fifth point. I am not optimistic about the value of the dollar. Well, Susan, there we do disagree. That is absolutely a disagreement, pure and simple. Bullish, I should say. The word optimistic is a little tendentious because optimistic depends on what you want the dollar to do. But right now, I believe the dollar is going to rally. I think that the fact is that people need dollars. They have to go out and get those dollars by hook or by crook. And obviously, that means for some people they've got to go into the foreign exchange market and buy those dollars. And that, in my opinion, will push the price of the dollar up. So I'm sorry that you weren't able to expound a little more in detail about why you're not optimistic about the value of the dollar, Susan. I would have loved to have followed your reasoning there. But anyway, and Susan N. saying, thanks for bringing such interesting and informative shows. Best regards, Susan. And thanks, Susan, for allowing me to have a little chat with you, albeit without the grace of your presence on the phone, which I would have loved to have had in order to be able to have drummed up some kind of a discussion about your points. All right, so Dana Cooper just wrote in a few moments ago saying, people keep saying, why bother to buy T-bills? So little interest, and it is owned by the government. How do you find a trusted financial advisor with a private boutique firm? I have my money with Chase Manhattan. Isn't that a steady bank? How can we track a bank's health? What about Swiss francs? Is it possible to buy them? I'm a green card holder. Do I just give it up and leave the country? Well, I did just that, Susan, Dana. I had a green card, and I renounced my permanent residence. I gave it up, I left the country, and I freed myself from the constraints of the IRS. To me, the United States not being a country where I think the future lies, Dana, you might want to do just that. You can buy the Swiss francs anywhere. Any bank will sell you Swiss francs. It is possible to buy them, yes. You can buy pretty much any currency which is available today. Some, like Indian rupees, require you to be in India to buy them, and it requires you to sell the excess rupees that you have in your pocket when you leave India. But in freely exchangeable currencies, you can buy them pretty much through any bank. You track banks' health by going to sites like Marty White's site, which will allow you to track the different banks' currencies. There are different sites which will allow you to log on and put the name of your bank in and get different kinds of surveys and different ratings. You can go to thestreet.com, for example. I'll just give you one example. Go to thestreet.com. They have a ratings site that will give you different banks. You can compare different banks. You can get the lowdown on your own bank just by putting in the name of the bank and the state. There are a number of very reputable sites out there which you can use to get a sounding on your own bank. T-bills, why bother to buy T-bills? Frankly, T-bills offer you a way to keep your money safe. I've always said that if the federal government is going to default, its treasury bills will be the last in the line of investments that they will default on. So you'll get plenty of notice if there is a problem with T-bills. But the other thing about T-bills is that because they're so short-term, the movement of interest rates cannot have any effect on your Treasury bills because you'll get them back at par in sort of less than 3 months. So there's no real reason to worry about the value of those Treasury bills. I would not buy government bonds of like 30 years or 10 years because they really could lose serious value over time, albeit temporarily, but you don't want to be caught with 30-year bonds and then need to cash them in after 8 years. You could be heavily in a losing situation at that point. So stay clear of all bonds, stay clear of government bonds and notes, and just stick to those famous Treasury bills and you'll do fine. All right. Let me just tell you about what's going on in the unemployment situation in Europe. It's pretty bad. The unemployment rate in the Eurozone is now 10.7%. This is the highest the unemployment rate has been since the introduction of the euro. The unemployment rate in the Eurozone never got any higher than 10.2% during the last recession. And this, of course, is very troubling news. Unemployment in Spain is at 19.9%, and in Greece it's 23.3%. It was just recently announced that the Eurozone has entered into another recession, and already the unemployment rate is hitting new record highs. I mean, how do I put this any other way? The problems for Europe are just starting. The European sovereign debt crisis continues to get worse, and another major global financial crisis is going to be here soon. The European Union has a larger population, a larger banking system, and more Fortune 500 companies than the United States. There hasn't even been a major financial crisis in Europe yet. So far, the powers that be have been able to keep Greece from defaulting and have been able to keep major banks all over Europe from collapsing. Well, let me tell you this, ladies and gentlemen. When the financial system of Europe crashes, the entire world will feel it. Okay, well, let's finish with a round of applause to Richard Nesbitt for the following piece of stunning information entitled Cost to Operate a Chevy Volt. Eric Bolling from Fox Business Channel's Follow the Money test drove the Chevy Volt at the invitation of General Motors. 4 days in a row, and a fully charged battery lasted only 25 miles before the Volt switched to the reserve gasoline engine. Eric calculated the car got 30 miles per gallon, including the 25 miles it ran on the battery. So the range, including the 9-gallon gas tank and the 16-kilowatt battery, is approximately 270 miles. It will take you 4.5 hours to drive 270 miles at 60 miles an hour. Then add 10 hours to charge the battery, and you have a total trip time of 14.5 hours. In a typical road trip, your average speed, including charge time, would be 20 miles an hour. According to General Motors, the Volt battery holds 16 kilowatts of electricity. It takes a full 10 hours to charge a drained battery. The cost for the electricity to charge the Volt is never mentioned. So I looked up what I pay for electricity. I pay approximately, it varies with the amount used in the seasons, $1.16 per kilowatt hours. 16 kilowatts times 1.16 per kilowatt hour is $18.56 to charge the battery. $18.56 per charge divided by 25 miles is 74 cents per mile to operate the Volt using the battery. Compare this to a similar-sized car with a gasoline engine only that gets 32 miles per gallon. $3.19 per gallon divided by 32 miles a gallon is 10 cents a mile. The gasoline-powered car costs about $15,000, while the Bolt costs $46,000. So Obama wants us to pay three times as much for a car that costs more than seven times as much to run and takes three times as long to drive across the country. Whoopee! Well done, Obama. You have just earned yourself the right to become president of the United States for another 4 years. Oh, well, I think we just have time for a quickie from Steve Kruger here. We are being conditioned to accept a police state. It starts slowly first with neighborhood watch programs supposedly to keep an eye on kids, but what it does is develop in people the idea that it's okay to snoop on others. Now we have signs upon exiting highways, quote, report all suspicious incidences and people, end of quote. The prevalence of cameras everywhere with more to come. This could lead to a point down the road when the government rounds groups of people who they deem anti-government and carts them off to FEMA camps. I think they want to ensure that this time round no one will be able to hide Anne Frank in their attic for any length of time. Steve Kruger. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, we've come to the end of the show. I wish you a wonderful weekend. I'll be back on Monday, same time, same place. This is Richard Martin wishing you a great time ahead. See you on Monday. Bye-bye.